I'm glad you came to watch my presentation. I was just joking that it's sort of a flashback to 20 years ago. I remember, I think it was my first internship as a library school student, was helping students use the brand new CD-ROM terminals that had been purchased with grant money at San Jose State University in California. And since then, I've worked with various types of like 12-inch laser discs and all sorts of crazy things. But luckily, we don't have to deal with these things as much anymore. But we still get a fair... I see these things come in, and we still subscribe to a fair number of materials that are distributed on CD, particularly in the data world, which is where I come from. I'm a data librarian. And they're... It's interesting in the data world, because one of the reasons why I think data ended up in libraries... How many of you come from an institution that has a data services department or a data librarian? Not too many. Well, okay. At many bigger research institutions, there was a time when data had to be processed, and by data I mean numeric data, had to be processed in some sort of campus computing center. Tapes came in from the government agencies or projects that produced it, and they got mounted on some mainframe computer, and people had to do their analysis on the same systems, time-sharing systems and such. And then round about the late 80s, I guess, CD-ROM technology became more viable. Plus, the government started cutting back to some degree on the amount of paper they were producing. So there are a variety of incentives to distribute information, large files on CDs. Plus, it was much cheaper technology to deal with. And it worked on workstations. Interestingly, there have, particularly with numeric data, there have been instances where basically the last computer that understood how to read a certain type of tape essentially died, and information was lost in some cases, like historical census information. So we should never really take it for granted that we will always have the technology to deal with these formats that right now seem fairly pervasive, like a CD. And that's part of my motivation for getting involved with this project. And then there's the other issue. My little arrows end up pointing to a website, and the web really sort of drives user expectations. So whatever sort of systems we develop, if we do anticipate users using them, we can't assume that they're going to have the same mindset that the people who sort of understood that they're going to have to stick a CD into a computer and maybe install some software or something like that. We can't really cater to that level of expectation now. We've got to assume that they're going to want a little bit more. This is an overview that pretty much sums up how I'm going to talk about my project. We literally do have our CDs in filing cabinets, and across our libraries, I'm going to just throw out a number that we have, say, 5,000 CDs. Now, I began this project, and still now, with the intention of addressing CDs that contained numeric and statistical information. Now, we do have a lot of other things that come, particularly government publications that come in on CD. There are some other research projects I'll talk about later that are looking at the issue of essentially I think I made up the word redigitizing, so don't go around quoting it like it's a real word. Also, the CD, I call it CDRIP. It also stands for CDs Rest in Peace, but I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings because, like I said, they're still used a lot. Where was I? Okay. So there are some other projects. There's a computer science professor at University of Indiana, one of the campuses, that is I think, looking for NSF money to basically redigitize all the public documents that have come out on CD. And I think there are a couple, I know of a couple data librarians that are interested and have presented on that topic and done some preliminary research as well. So there are growing numbers of people that realize this is something that should be addressed. And I think they also realize one of the motivations is that it's not that hard to do, and that's what I'll also talk about. So along the way, I will briefly touch on some of the technology issues. I don't want to get too bogged down in tech details, but some of you might find it a little bit interesting. At the end, I'll just talk about some future directions this type of work might go. So why did I do it? I've talked about that a little bit. But we want to make it more convenient for people to get at these legacy, I'm going to call them legacy materials. Right now, it literally does involve, in most instances, getting a librarian to fetch a CD out of a filing cabinet, and then maybe or maybe not being able to install the software from that CD onto a workstation. Now, that being said, we do have a fairly extensive wide area network of networked CDs, sort of the old model of using CDs in research libraries. And that's still maintained and there's a lot of overhead to maintaining it. I think there's pretty much one FTE that deals with this thing. I don't off the top of my head know the number of titles, but it has its benefits, but it also has some drawbacks too, because for various reasons, they really lock down the machines that they give access to the network on. And for my users in data services, that often gets in the way, because I want them to be using computers that have statistical software or at least Excel or Access. And in our local situation anyway, the network CD-ROMs are only available on these machines that have basically no permissions for saving files to disk, because they're worried about copyright issues, I won't go into that. But anyway, so it's not a great service to our users, and I think some of the materials are underutilized. And in fact, one of the reasons that I was motivated to take on this was I basically wanted to create my own caches of the statistical databases that were on the CD-ROM network, because I got tired of reinstalling these things. Plus, there are technical reasons why you don't want to install and uninstall software on your fairly finicky data workstations. So better access, that's fairly obvious. There's a number of things we can do to improve access if we network or at least redigitize this stuff. And then preservation. No one knows how long CDs will last. Also, a lot of this material came out in that kind of transition period between print and online, when you can't assume that things have been put online just because they once existed electronically on a CD. So there's a fair amount of government information and other types of publications that have that are on CD that you probably won't find in print. And then hardware availability that I alluded to earlier. And that I should qualify that, say, hardware and software availability. I know of one instance that I've had to deal with where we had economic data from Mexico, and I tried to install the software on a modern, you know, two-year-old computer, and the CPU was actually too fast to run the software. And the only way we could actually get the thing to run was to find an old computer that was slow enough to run the software. So there's weird things like that, and I'll talk about how I'm trying to deal with those, because I think that's one of the more interesting things I've done so far. The cons to the approach I've taken, copyright issues are the greatest, because it would be very easy for a vendor to raise objections to, they might claim that you're violating copyright issues. In my mind, I think we have a record we purchase on CD. So when I'm unsure of what the permissions are that we have, I essentially consider it a dark or gray archive where I'm only going to basically rebuild the CD if I need it. But a lot of our information we've either purchased permission to put it on a network, or it's government information where we're legally entitled to put it up in to as many users as we want. The other con would be that I suspect that this information will be, as time progresses, of declining interest to our users, but you know, that's never really stopped libraries before. And we might even turn that into a pro in the sense that if these things stay in filing cabinets, they're taking up space, taking up librarian time, trying to track them down and figure out how to install them. So low use might actually be a good reason to do what I'm doing. So the production process. Basically, I hire students who sit at a workstation. We bring them boxes of CDs. They run a free software utility that takes the CD and burns an image file of it. By image file, I mean it's an image file that's in the ISO format. And what that does is it takes the entire contents of the CD and reduces it to a single file. So I'm not talking about directories and directories full of files that I'm moving around. Basically, like for instance, we have a China census that comes on DVD and has literally tens of thousands of files, HTML and Excel spreadsheets on it. That gets burned into one, say, 4 gigabyte file. The beauty of that format is, one, it's a standard. Most CD burning software will just take that image and burn a DVD or a CD from that image. Basically, point and click. It's that easy. The other thing is that on Unix systems and on Mac systems, the operating system understands that ISO is a CD, and if you click on it, it essentially opens it up and it looks like another drive, basically. And you can get access to the files or the software that's on the CD. In Windows, there's another layer of software involved in mounting that ISO image so that it looks like a CD. But the thing to remember is that basically that ISO is just the software equivalent of a CD. I'm standardized on that format. There are other formats out there, but right now it seems like a good one to be standardized on. Cheap hardware. Disk space is cheap. So I start out with what our systems department calls a data brick. It's got a 2.5 gig of storage on it. With 1,500 CDs, I've filled up less than 0.7 gigs of space on it. Free software when possible. I've mentioned a utility that we use for burning ISOs called LC ISO Creator. Daemon Tools is something that comes from the gaming community, and it's a pretty cool application that takes those ISO files and mounts them so that they appear to be disk drives on a workstation. It also, but you didn't hear from me, knows how to crack a lot of encryption schemes too, but that's usually not a problem with our software. That's more something gamers are concerned with. I should contrast this approach to what has been common practice for probably 5 or 10 years, where you put a CD on a server, and then server software kind of makes that software the image available as a drive that you can mount. I'm basing it all on the workstation, which is more flexible for a large-scale project like that. The old approach makes more sense when you want to have a manageable number of CDs available over a network, say 10, 20, 100, maybe up to 100. But the assumption there is you're probably going to have the software permanently installed and maintained and updated. My approach is kind of like a library approach. Put it all up there, and then you deal with each one on an individual basis. That being said, if I do want to install any permanently, if we have a network license, I can do it. I can do that too. Basically, free software when possible. I have developed some of my own software just for doing little tasks along the way. And I'm using existing standards, so I haven't created any standalone databases. I'm using XML, and I can talk about, and mods records to keep track of the work I'm doing. One of the values of this process is that I'm adding additional metadata to the catalog records. All these materials are cataloged, sort of. And the reason I say sort of, and this is probably the biggest problem I've run into, and the other people working in this area have run into, is that individual CDs, if they're in a collection, are not uniquely identified. And this is a huge problem with U.S. federal publications. There is one SUDOC number for a whole group of things. Now, within the library, we barcode CDs, so the case is barcoded. But there's really no way to uniquely identify a CD. So there are things like digital fingerprints, which create these huge strings of random digits that we'll have to rely on ultimately to figure out if something that I have is the equivalent to something another library has. But that's going to be a technology solution. I use XML instead of a database. It's really good for hierarchical data, and mostly what I'm dealing with are directories of things. This is just a representation of my archive directory. I also, for added value, create an XML record of the whole directory listing of the CD. And what that does is it allows me to, I can then analyze the contents of the CD and figure out what sort of software requirements there might be. So does the CD contain executable programs? Does it contain PDFs? Does it contain Excel files or DBF files or something that might be able to be used with other applications? So we can do a lot of analysis on our collection. And ultimately, I do expect to have file-level access to everything in my repository that I'm entitled to put up or to make available in that way. So I can disaggregate the contents of the CDs. I've used the Perl language. It's for those who program. There are a number of existing libraries, programming libraries for library applications. And I'll talk about one thing that I did in particular. Catalog. Basically, I didn't want to burden anyone with cataloging each of these things that had already been cataloged. I didn't even really want to burden anyone with copying and pasting or any type of data entry except when there are problems. So I wrote a little application, what's called a REST application, interfaced with our library catalog. And this is like a sidebar, so this isn't critical to my project, but it was really convenient, and I think it's something good to bring up in electronic resources context. Essentially, I've given two examples of URLs here. This URL right here is what it takes to pull up a catalog record for one known item by an ID number, and that's an ugly thing. You could, even if you emailed that to someone or tried to copy and paste it into a link in a web page, there's a good chance you'll get something wrong. REST is actually a lot more complicated than this, but it's an earmark of REST is these clean URLs that actually have functionality built into them. So you can sort of see what's going on. I'm passing a command to the library database through a clean URL that makes some sense. So it's finding something by its Gladys ID number. You can also add other parameters to that. And this allowed me to do a lot of easy programming to pull information out of our catalog. And I had to basically write a program to that. Now, this would be a function of a lot of modern catalogs, but I'm dealing with a legacy system that has very little, it has web technology, but it looks like that, the upper thing, and it has no XML interface or anything like that. So it saved me time, data entry time, being able to script a lot of this stuff out. Anyway, that's the end of the sidebar. just a little example of what that utility does. That's a mods record that's pulled out of a legacy system that only deals with MARC. To go back to the flowchart, I don't have too much to say about the file server. I'll talk about the future in a little bit. The main thing to get is you see the CDs going into the production and then the bytes, the ones and zeros coming out. Once the CDs are done, they go back in the filing cabinet, and from there on out, we're just dealing with the bytes and however we've uniquely identified them in our system. The file server, simple technology. Where things start to get interesting and is on the user tools, which at this point, some have been tested, but I've mainly put all my efforts into getting the stuff redigitized. So let me talk about my approach to for user access tools. So the wiki pages, that's just a useful way for me to create lists of the contents of my archives, as opposed to, say, a dynamic website or a static website or something like that. I like to keep clean sort of navigation, and I also like to leverage the some of the other capability of the wiki pages. One of my ideas behind using a wiki is that I thought that it would be a good way to add notes to some of the records for these items, notes about the software, notes on how to install the software, questions. Again, that's a concept at this point. I can generate wiki content automatically, but we'll see if it pans out allowing people. I don't think I'll let the general public edit the pages, but I will probably people that are logged into my data lab as data lab users, and also our library staff will be able to make notes on these pages, and then they will get a feed from the catalog to pop, make sure we have the current catalog entry on that particular item. The interesting thing that one of the more useful technologies that I've learned about through this project is virtual machine technology. And this is actually critical to the success of this project because, among other things, it allows users to safely install applications on otherwise locked down workstations. So I have people can log into my computers in my data lab and get into a workspace that allows them to save files, but it doesn't allow them to install anything. And that's pretty important for me because I don't have a lot of workstations, and I don't like having downtime when I have to sort of rebuild these. And the configurations are always changing because of the way statistical software is licensed and a variety of other things. So what I decided was I was going to use a virtual machine. So what a virtual machine does is it's literally a computer within a computer. And maybe if I do the next slide, and we can talk about search later because that's just something that's in the planning stage. There's a wiki page with some output that was dynamically generated from my archive. So here's a screen that shows VMware, which is the virtual machine software, starting up within Windows. So it's going to be running Windows within Windows, and it literally is a virtual computer. That second instance of Windows has to have a license, so there are two versions of Windows on there. However, and this is the key factor here, is that within that virtual machine, the user does not have access, they cannot alter the underlying system. Everything's in essentially a safe sandbox. And so if they save a file, if they run something with a virus in it, it's not going to contaminate my computer. It's only going to contaminate their virtual computer. Now, it does have network access, so they could get into some mischief sending stuff out on the network, but it's not going to destroy the underlying machine. And it basically can do everything that Windows can do. Plus, we can tweak certain things like CPU speed and memory and a variety of other components of a computer, but do it all in software. And then all of that is saved in a configuration file. The beauty of it is, too, that another really compelling thing about it is that we can run any operating system. So I have a vision here of being able to run free operating systems that run Windows emulation, and we'll be able to run for some of these hard-to-use legacy applications, old applications that came out of government agencies or foreign agencies. We may be able to run those under emulation and then basically bundle the whole thing in a file, and companies like VMware and I think at least VMware, and there may be others now, actually have a free client that you can download. So we could distribute these pre-configured applications so that people could basically just drag and play these using a free client that they can download off the internet and have all the capabilities of the software. And that technology does work right now, but it's severely constrained right now because of most of these applications are dependent on Windows, and I can't go around. If I send someone a VMware bundle to use in their VMware client, I'm violating the law if I'm not also giving them a licensed copy of Windows. That's just more to give you an idea of this is Windows booting inside Windows. And then this is actually someone browsing the network drive in my archive, finding 2006 California budget.iso. So that's the representation of a CD product. I probably should have put a picture of it, but there's a CD that contains the entire California budget. There they've clicked on it, and then here I am browsing the directories on that CD as if it were. You can see there's no confusing intermediate levels of software. It's basically just a Windows folder. That's how it appears. And then there's the application just running within Windows. So that's the approach that I'll take for CDs that require some sort of installation. Or probably a vast majority of, given the context, or whether they're running in a lab or not, a vast majority of our CDs would be accessible this way. All right, so what sorts of projects are on the horizon besides getting everything copied? Okay, one really important thing is essentially getting these materials into our preservation pipeline. And by that, I mean we have to add, basically I have a file that could go into our preservation repository, but there needs to be additional metadata added to it, given the current system that we have now. So it's one step closer for some of these rare materials that we want to make sure are preserved. And a lot of the additional metadata can be generated automatically at our library. So that's sort of low-hanging fruit. So I will begin to identify materials that I want to put into preservation this calendar year. Another goal is to be able to publish these materials to the web where we're not restrained from doing so by copyright. And really all I can publish the ISOs, put the ISOs up to allow file sharing so that other libraries could, say, replace lost copies or grab something that a user had identified. I think this is going to be of a lot of value to the government documents community. And it's going to be of a lot of value to libraries that really don't want to maintain physical collections of CDs or don't want to maintain collections of virtual CDs either. They should be able, I'm sure we'll have a good repository within a few years where you can basically get anything that the government's ever put out. Data mining is something that holds a lot of potential. So once I get these things digitized, technology-wise, it's not hard to essentially mount them on the fly, grab all the files, index them, and create new tools for doing content analysis and finding obscure stuff. There's lots of readable material. Many languages are represented. And that's, who knows what sort of projects might materialize out of that. File sharing, I mentioned. I've talked to the other people that are doing these things a bit about this. We could use protocols like BitTorrent or other types of peer-to-peer or even just simple FTP sites for sharing sharing the files that we're creating. And then the last thing I've also alluded to is further virtualization projects. I can envision there being a collaborative project to develop these sort of open source bundles of legacy applications so that you could actually run a Windows 3.1 application on some sort of government distributed CD completely in a virtual environment and in a format that could be freely shared. That type of technology exists today using things like the Wine emulator that runs under Linux and then using the free VMware client, which is a commercial application, but it's like Adobe Reader or something. You can download it for free, and then whoever's distributing the application has to have the server or workstation product in order to create the bundle that people can read with the free reader. So very analogous to what Adobe does. So there are a number of things that, and I'm sure I haven't thought of half of the potential projects that might be possible. This is, I just wanted to get this in the slide if people wanted more information. This is Professor Jeffrey Brown's webpage. Talks a little bit about the work he's doing. He's employed basically the same types of technology that I have and has a similar amount of materials archived. He's looking for NSF money, so hopefully he'll get a good grant and be able to do some full-time work on this. And then there's also a posting on freegovinfo.info it has to do with a presentation similar to the one I'm giving now that a couple of librarians, one from NYU and the other from Yale, that have also done some preliminary work in this area. And they've got an entry on this freegovinfo blog, and I think you can get to their PowerPoints through that. So I don't know if I have to read over all of this, but it might stimulate your minds for some questions to ask now. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
Just out of curiosity, have you tried anything with Microsoft's new Vista?
I haven't yet.
And the only reason I say that is because I know that it just isn't the same as XP, and it treats files and formats differently than XP did. And we're finding things that, you know, would normally come up under XP and should be transportable, but it's not.
Well, see, that's another. I'm glad you brought that up because I probably didn't talk about it enough when I was talking about the VM or virtual machine software. That I think it's particularly aware that these things exist for that very reason, because we do have a lot of software in our collections, and we do, and even if we don't, we ought to be concerned with providing that type of service. So we should have collections of operating systems. So I would like to have everything back to DOS 1.0 or whatever. And it's really no problem to run those under VMware. It's actually a huge issue in the archival community, this being able to preserve these legacy materials and get access to the files, because right now we take a doc file or an XLS file. We take it for granted. You're just going to click on it and Excel is going to open, you're going to run it. But what about the person who goes to an archive 100 years from now? There probably will be some compatibility. Ultimately, I think IBM has done a lot of research into just basically creating sort of operating system independent software, so having sort of virtualization kind of built into the computer so that essentially there would be ways to read files from now until eternity. But see, I don't trust it. I have a lot more trust that people can write these emulators, and I have a lot of trust in the open source community doing a lot of this work too, because it seems to me that if you can take something like Linux that runs, that has strong, a lot of momentum, it's free, it runs on inexpensive hardware that we can imagine running for a long time. If we can do all our virtualization within Linux, then we have a sort of, it's not a forever type preservation scenario, but it's a longer term preservation scenario than, it's sort of like an intermediate solution in preservation. And hopefully we can avoid situations like I talked about before where the last computer that could read this certain type of application and data died essentially before they could retrieve all the data off of it, off of the tapes. There's one other thing I can talk about with virtual machines. It's not limited to just software, but it's actually a pretty big industry buzzword right now because virtualization is being done on the server side, which means that you buy one very expensive server and then you can run multiple instances of servers on there. So you're only maintaining like one hard drive array, one CPU, one set of memory, and then the virtualization software allows you to run different services for, you might have an application that only runs under Linux, you might have one that runs under Solaris, you might have something else that runs under Windows, whatever the network version of Windows is, and all those can run on the same hardware, same machine. And, you know, that's of interest to, like, library IT people, but we get asked to, say, preserve websites. And that's one thing when you're trying to capture static pages, but guess what? A lot of websites are database-driven. And so what's it really going to take to preserve a database-driven website? I mean, you can't screen capture every iteration of that database. That's, you know, next to impossible. But what if you could, had the version of the operating system, particularly since a lot of websites run off of open source software, it's not hard to imagine being able to basically grab all the parameters of the system that it was running on, grab their data, and then essentially run it on a virtual server. And that's what I think preservation is going to be of some of the dynamic websites that are out there right now. Of course, that's really simplistic because a lot of the software isn't free that's driving websites. But, I mean, at sort of the National Archive level, I suspect they probably will have some solution like that. Who knows? Any other questions? Yeah?
I have a little question. I don't know. Oh. Is this project going to use any Library of Congress developed methods?
METS? Yeah, when I talked about the preservation pipeline, we do, at California Digital Library, it does use, we do use METS. So essentially what it would take, that's really just sort of an information flow. So basically we would submit files, our files, the files that I'm creating with a METS record, and then it would get ingested into the That's sort of the basic bundle of information that we would submit to our preservation archive. Is that she asked if we were going to be using METS metadata.
Yeah.